The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This is Paul Smith, author of The 10 Stories Great Leaders Tell, and you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which was named by Forbes as one of 11 smart podcasts that will keep you in the know, and named by LinkedIn as one of 10 podcasts that will make you a better marketer. My goal for this podcast is to help us both keep up with the latest ideas in the quickly changing field of modern marketing and sales. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's show notes at MarketingBookPodcast.com. And since you're a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or some other helpful resource that I know of for whatever situation you find yourself in, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat and I'll try to point you in the right direction and save you time. This show is a labor of love that I do in my spare time. My day job is running a marketing agency where we work with manufacturers to help them grow. If that sounds like your company and you're serious about growth, check out our guide to lead generation for manufacturers on our website, salesartillery.com, or Google lead generation for manufacturers, and you'll find the guide atop the organic results. Now, the number one worry I hear from listeners is that they feel they aren't reading enough books to be more successful. So, special thanks to this episode's sponsor, Blinkist, which is an app that takes the key insights from the best nonfiction books and distills them into a format that you can read or listen to in just a few minutes on your smartphone. Several of the books featured on the Marketing Book Podcast are on Blinkist. You can sign up for free at Blinkist.com/marketingbookpodcast. Blinkist is spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. And if you opt for the paid version, you'll get an additional 20% off, but only if you go to Blinkist.com/marketingbookpodcast. I also have a link to it at marketingbookpodcast.com. And now, on with the show. Today, we welcome Paul Smith back to the Marketing Book Podcast to talk about his new book, The 10 Stories Great Leaders Tell, published by Sourcebooks. Paul Smith is one of the world's leading experts in business storytelling. He's one of Inc. magazine's top 100 leadership speakers, a storytelling coach, and best-selling author of the books Sell with a Story, Parenting with a Story, and Lead with a Story. Paul's also a former consultant at Accenture and a former executive and 20-year veteran of the Procter & Gamble Company. His work's been featured in The Wall Street Journal, Inc. magazine, Times, Forbes, Fast Company, The Washington Post, and London's Financial Times, amongst many others. Paul delivers professional workshops and keynote addresses on effective storytelling for leaders and salespeople. His clients include companies I've never heard of, like Hewlett-Packard, Google, Ford Motor Company, Bayer Medical, and Procter & Gamble. Paul holds a bachelor's degree in economics and an MBA from the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Paul, congratulations on the 10 Stories Great Leaders Tell, and welcome back to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Hey, thanks. Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me back on.
Well, so you were episode 87 when you were on for Sell with a Story, and this will probably be episode 255. So, Paul, I just want you to know you don't have to wait 168 episodes to come back. And I don't know if that makes you want to write even more books, but
it does. And I'm glad you did that math for me real quick. I was trying to do that in my head. And wow, you've been busy since last we spoke.
Yeah, well, and I've even had some other books on about storytelling. And I got to tell you that this is where, you know, I have to make an admission. I never really understood this concept of business storytelling until I read Sell with a Story. Mm. And I had always just thought it sounded like another... I know I was ignorant. I still am.
No,
I'm sure.
Right.
But it sounded like another marketing BS buzzword.
Yeah.
And then I read the book and I understood what storytelling is, and I'm going to ask you to recap that again, because I know you've been asked that tens of thousands of times. But I should say, though, I'm still nervous about marketers who go back to work and talk to civilians, like salespeople or management, about storytelling. And my concern is that there are a lot of people who look at marketers as arts and crafts party planners who work in the Make It Pretty department because they don't understand what marketers do. They don't understand much about marketing. That's an observation, not a criticism. And when they go in and they say, boss, now we're going to do storytelling, they're going to think you're a camp counselor. And that's why I'm just nervous about folks using that term unless their organization knows about that. So did I just see that this book was a finalist for an award?
Yeah, you did. But let me just comment on what you just said. I think that's a fair concern to have. And I think it's a fair concern because people mean all kinds of things by storytelling these days. And I think the people you're talking about are the ones that just think, oh, the storytelling, that's the latest shiny object. And oh, so we're going to do storytelling. So all of our marketing plans are going to be stories. All of our copy is going to be stories. All of our mission statement is going to be, everything's going to be a story. And what they probably don't really know what they're talking about, and B, all they mean is, well, I want it to be more effective. So I want it to, it's all going to tie together this grand narrative, and it's all going to be consistent. And well, that's fine. You can have grand narratives and consistency between your marketing elements, and not have a single story, and that's fine. I think you'll be more effective if you have a few stories. But I think people, if they're just reacting to, hey, that's the latest buzzword, and we need to do it. Yeah, that can be dangerous if they think they know what they're doing and they don't. So my advice is always, if you want to learn to play the guitar, hire a guitar teacher. If you want to learn to play the piano, go take piano lessons. If you want to do storytelling, fine, but go learn from somebody who knows what they're doing. Don't just start telling stories at random. They're probably not going to be very good.
No, I think it's a little more, I don't know, for lack of a better word, there's a little more science to it.
There is. And that's what I try and do. So this new book, The 10 Stories Great Leaders Tell. Yeah, I got a note from my publisher just a few days ago saying that it had made the top five in what's called the OWL, or maybe they call them the OWLies. I'm sure that would be the cute, funny name for it. But I think it stands for the Outstanding Works of Literature Award that BookPal puts out. And they're a publisher, a retail seller of books like Amazon. And they got lots of categories, memoirs and comedies and whatever. But one of their categories is leadership books. And I think mine was in the top five. And they haven't announced who's number one yet. So I'm still in the running for number one. But I was honored to be in the top five so far. So I'm happy about that.
Well, Paul, I'll make some calls. Don't worry.
Please do. If you know people.
Yes. So let's talk about one word that's in the book title that I think, in addition to storytelling, people may not understand, and that's what a leader is. And my concern is that a listener, if they're still listening, they're going to say, oh, that's the 10 stories great leaders tell. That's for the CEO. No, it's not. You could be a person that doesn't even have any direct reports, and you are a leader in your organization.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think when we get into the 10 stories, I think that will become obvious to people. They'll go, oh, yeah, of course, I need to tell that story, and I'm not the boss of anybody. So, yeah, that word leaders, what that means is, yeah, clearly, if you are the CEO, yeah, you absolutely need it. And if you're a senior executive and you got lots of people reporting to you, yes, you definitely need it. But anyone who wants to exert some influence in the organization and help the organization be successful in your contact with either other people in the organization or the outside world, then you are in a position to lead the thinking, lead the what people think and do about your product and or service. So yeah, I think it has broader applications than just the executive suite.
Yes, and Paul didn't put me up to this, but I think this would be a great gift to give to your CEO. But if there's other intermediate higher people in the chain of command, make sure to give them one a copy too.
Yeah, my publisher was kind enough to put a little to and from bubble on the front page, so you could definitely make it a nice little gift.
Yeah. Oh, I see what they did. Okay. I'm not always catching on to these things.
You're there now, man.
Yeah, you can smell the wood burning here in the in the studio. So this book is billed as a 1-hour read. And when you're the Marketing Book Podcast host, you have to, make sure these authors are telling the truth. So I timed myself.
You timed yourself, didn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah. Yeah. It's right. The struggle. I suffer for my art. But, I do it out of love for the audience. So I read it, but it took me an hour and 16 minutes. And the only reason why is because I kept stopping to write stuff down that was helpful for us, my company, or various clients that we need to go do. So darn you, Paul Smith. But
well, that's a good use of an extra 16 minutes, I think. Okay.
Yeah, probably so. Probably so. So, and also,
by the way, so you probably haven't timed yourself with other books you read, but do you have a good feel for roughly how long it takes you to read a typical book?
Yes. I think that it takes me as long to read it as it would take to drive that many miles. So, in other words, a 200-page book might be 4 hours.
Okay.
Does that make sense? Like if you're going about 200 miles, I know in Ohio you guys drive really fast, but
yeah. So yeah, and that's pretty fast, I think. So you obviously read a lot, so you're no slouch at reading. But like my first three books, were north of 200 pages, 250, 280, something like that. And I think what I've heard is that they're typically more in the 8 to 9 hour read, but maybe that's a for slow readers. Anyway, the point is, this book is significantly shorter than that.
Yeah.
Right. It's a fraction of the size of a typical book. So it really is designed for you to pick up, when the airplane takes off, and by the time you land, you're going to have finished the book and have some good ideas.
Yeah. And maybe even a cocktail.
Yeah. That's it.
But yeah, it's only 99 pages. And my sense is that writing a 99-page book is much more difficult than writing a 400-page book. But that's just, I haven't written a book, so I don't know. But you know what? There was an author on the show not too long ago who's a professor at Wharton, Peter Fader.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God.
Was he one of your professors?
He was my marketing professor.
No kidding. Well, he and Sarah Toms from Wharton Digital, they wrote a book about customer centricity, and it was very much about determining customer lifetime value to determine your marketing activities and how much you should budget and so forth. A whole book about customer lifetime value, which, as I often say, that's why marketers, amongst other things, need to know what the customer lifetime value is of their customers. But it was only 104 pages. Brilliantly done. And it was not as if a PhD wrote it. It was really, really well done. So he was one of your professors. Now, you were there after Jonah Berger started, probably. Or you were there before he came? Because that's another author I've interviewed from there.
Yeah, and I'm drawing a blank on that name. So I was there...
He's a younger guy.
1991 to 1993.
Okay. And, Peter Fader, sorry not to make this all about Paul Smith, but he actually has math degrees from MIT, and so he was the perfect example of how marketing has gone from madmen to mathmen.
Yeah, very analytical now.
Yeah, yeah. So your book also has a very helpful checklist at the end. And I just want to read an excerpt from the beginning, and then we can start to get into some of these stories and an explanation of what is meant by storytelling.
Right.
Every great leader is a great storyteller. And the first and most important part of being a great storyteller is knowing what stories to tell. Ironically, journalists and publishers are typically interested in producing content on how to craft leadership stories, the structure of the story, emotional elements, the right level of detail, how long they should be, etc. But when I work with executives, actual leaders working in organizations, those aren't the first questions they ask. The first question they typically ask is, what stories do I need to tell? The reason I side with the executives on what's of foremost importance is that if you tell the right story but butcher the delivery, your audience will forgive you. You're not a novelist or a professional speaker. You're a leader. But if you tell your people a boring, irrelevant story, even if you deliver it in a way that would make a Shakespearean actor proud, your audience will never forgive you for wasting their time. So, Paul, explain why you did not title your book The 10 Speeches Great Leaders Make, or The 10 Presentations Great Leaders Give, or 10 Ideas Great Leaders Share.
Yeah, thank you. Good question. Because to me, it needs to be a story for it to be of utmost help and to be the most effective, right? I mean, every leader should have speeches that, you know, that they give and presentations they give, of course they're going to. But I wanted to focus on the stories they needed to tell, because they're going to be different from the speeches they give and the ideas that they share. And in fact, as you know, my last 7 or 8 years of my life has been dedicated to documenting all the types of stories that leaders and marketers and salespeople tell. And I've probably, gosh, at this point, I probably documented 70 different individual types of stories that people tell. And in my books, there's 250 different examples. And those, by the way, are the best ones out of the probably 3,000 or so stories I've documented after interviewing all these hundreds of leaders all over the world. In 25 different countries.
And but in Sell With a Story, wasn't it like 24 stories that
25.
25? Yeah,
25 types of stories that salespeople in particular tell. Marketers obviously help them with those, crafting a lot of those stories as well. But this was my attempt to focus on, okay, gosh, Paul, that's a lot of stories. What are the most important ones? Mm-hmm. So I wanted to put together a book, a short little book, to just focus on the most important 10 stories I think any leader needs to be able to tell.
Well, let me ask what is probably the dumbest question you'll ever get, but what is meant by a story? For instance, does that mean making something up, Paul Smith?
It does not. So, and that's not a dumb question. That's a question I have to cover in the first 20 minutes of, you know, every client interaction and training course I teach, because people do think it means a lot of different things. So when I say story, no, I don't mean something that you make up at all. Although there will be some kinds of stories that will be fictional, and we'll talk about those in a little bit. But most of the stories you tell as a leader will be real stories about real things that happen to real people. So when I say a story, I mean an actual narrative about something that happened to someone. All right. So that means there'll be a time, there'll be a place, there'll be a main character. That main character's got some kind of a goal. There's someone or something getting in the way of that goal, you know, a villain, if you will. And there are events that transpire along the way that resolve themselves in the end, either in a success or a failure. So I literally mean a story about something that happened to someone, not, you know, here are three reasons to buy my product, or here are the four big ideas I want you to focus on this year. Or, I mean, those are talking points or bullet points, or that's a message track, or, you know, the slides in your presentation. Those aren't stories. Those are bullet points. Those are lists of ideas or lists of reasons to buy what I'm selling. A story is a narrative about something that happened to someone.
Okay. So why then is that so important? Maybe we got to talk about the brain or whatever, but explain why that is so powerful and the benefits of putting something in story format.
Yeah, so there are a lot of reasons, but the most important one, I think, and especially for marketers, is that it turns out human beings don't make the rational, logical decisions that we'd like to think we make. I mean, there's been lots of cognitive science done on this in the last couple of decades, and what we've learned is that many, if not most, human decisions are made in a subconscious, emotional processing part of the brain, and then we justify those decisions rationally and logically a few nanoseconds later in a more conscious thinking part of the brain. So we leave a decision-making process thinking we made it for these rational, logical reasons, and they certainly influenced it to some extent. But usually the real decision's already been made in that, you know, reptilian part of the brain that we're really not in touch with consciously for more, you know, emotional reasons. And so it turns out if you want to influence what people think and feel and do, in other words, leadership or marketing, it turns out you need to talk to both parts of the brain. And stories are just uniquely qualified to do that. Whereas your features and benefits focused marketing is not. Your logical, rational reason why your direct report should go do what you're telling them to do just don't speak to that other part of the brain. But stories speak to both parts of the brain, the conscious and the subconscious, the rational and the emotional, right? So that's the main reason. Now, there are a lot of other reasons as well, and I cover a few in the book, like things are more memorable when they're delivered via a story, like literally 5-10 times as likely you are to remember the details of something if those details are embedded in a story than if they're just given to people in a list. You know, so there are some other practical reasons, but that main one is because it helps people make decisions better.
And it seems that I've read that if you can get through the subconscious or the reptilian part, the older part of our brain, it's the cognitive part, the slower moving part, you actually have a better chance of engaging that. But if you don't get through the reptilian part, you're not going to have much luck with the more logical part of the brain.
Yeah, that could be. And what's certainly true is that you're only speaking to the logical part. And mm-hmm. and that's good, but it's not good enough if you really want to have the most effective chance of influencing somebody.
We're going to take a break here so I can tell you more about how Blinkist might be the answer to one of your biggest worries. As I mentioned earlier, the number one worry I hear from listeners is that they feel they aren't reading enough books to keep up and be more successful. But there's only so much time and you need to manage it carefully. And unless you're, say, the host of the Marketing Book Podcast, you may not be set up to read a book every week. That's where Blinkist can really be a time saver and a career booster. Blinkist is a smartphone app that takes the key insights from over 3,000 best-selling nonfiction books and distills them into a format that you can read or listen to in just 15 minutes or less. Instead of having to wade through hundreds of pages of a book, spending hours reading each book like I do every week, you can go through two books in 30 minutes. And the books that are on Blinkist are from top-notch authors, many of whom have been guests on the Marketing Book Podcast, including Seth Godin, Guy Kawasaki, Robert Cialdini, Philip Kotler, David Meerman Scott, Anne Hanley, Bob Berg, John Jantz, Jonah Berger, Jill Conrath, Jeb Blunt, and many, many more. Over 40 authors who have been on the show. Blinkist has been selected as one of the best apps by Forbes, the New York Times, and BuzzFeed, amongst others, and it's used by over 10 million people. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer for Marketing Book Podcast listeners. Go to Blinkist.com/marketingbookpodcast right now, today, to start your free trial or get 20% off your yearly plan when you join. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. Blinkist.com/marketingbookpodcast to start your free trial or get 20% off your yearly plan. And there's no risk because there's a free 7-day trial. Go to Blinkist.com/marketingbookpodcast. And that means you're going to be letting them know that you support the Marketing Book Podcast and that you want that discount. You'll get the free version or 20% off your annual plan. I also have a link to it at marketingbookpodcast.com. It's a very smart investment in your success. And now, back to the show. Yes, and just I think yesterday I was watching a webinar from Corporate Visions, and they gave an analogy for these two parts that we're talking about, and I'm going to steal it, as I do many ideas, but I've given them full attribution here. And they talked about how the lizard, the older part, I think it's the amygdala, that is more like a horse, and the logical part is the person riding the horse. Yeah. And if you've ever been on a horse or ever been thrown from a horse like I have, the horse is kind of in control. So that's where the emotions are much more in control of the logical side. So enough about that. Can you just walk us through what the different stories are that you picked? One of the things about your book that I found so interesting is which ones you picked.
Yeah.
out of all those hundreds. And then maybe talk about how did you pick them? But either question.
Yeah. So let me explain how I picked them first, and then we'll get into what the 10 are. So I basically used four criteria because I had a lot of stories, as I mentioned earlier, to consider for the top 10. Types of stories. Yeah. Right. So here are the four criteria that I used. First of all, I wanted to pick stories that my clients most frequently asked me for help on. So, and you kind of read, you know, part of that in the first part of the book there. Mm-hmm. And that way I knew I would be getting practical stories that I knew there was some demand out there that leaders wanted to know how to tell these stories. So I literally just looked back at my last 7 years of clients and what stories they were asking me to help them develop. So that was the first criteria. The second one was I wanted to pick areas where I knew leaders in general needed to influence. And that was honestly just my own 20 some odd years in the business world, you know, having worked in lots of different levels of management and different job functions and different companies. These are areas that I know, and you'll know when you read them, and your audience will know them when they hear them. Yeah, those are the kind of areas that leaders need to influence in a business. Mm-hmm. So that was my second criteria. The third criteria was I wanted to pick stories where I knew all job functions of leaders would benefit from being able to tell these stories, as opposed to these are only stories that salespeople will tell, or only marketers, or only engineers, or IT, or human resources, or whatever. I wanted stories that I knew that any leader at an organization would benefit from being able to tell these stories. So that was criteria three. And then the last one was I wanted to pick stories that I thought wouldn't need to change very often. And the reason was because I wanted to pick stories where I thought people, it would make sense for them to spend time getting this story right, because you're going to have to tell it a lot. And in fact, some of these stories are going to be useful to you for many years and some decades, as opposed to some stories you'll tell as a leader. You'll tell it once or twice, and then the need is gone. You've already accomplished the objective, so I'll never need to tell that story again. These 10 stories are all going to have a much longer shelf life. So those are the four criteria. Let me just interject
that, like, in other words, you'll say one's a customer story or a sales story, but the truth is, Paul Smith, some of these things work for multiple issues. In other words, a founding story, which you're going to talk about, works in sales. It works in marketing. It works in recruiting, which are other areas here. So it's not just limited, I would think, to how you've described them and how you're going to describe it in just a minute.
Right. Yeah, and that was the point. I wanted to pick stories that I knew that could be useful. That was criteria number three, remember. I wanted them to be useful to people, leaders in all kinds of job functions. So yes, one of them is a sales story. But it's not just going to be the salespeople that would tell a story. Surely, the CEO of the company is going to have to be able to tell at least one sales story. And just about everybody at some point is going to be in a position to try and explain what your company does for your customer. Right. Well, guess what? That's a sales story. Right. Now, if you work in IT, do you need to be able to tell, all 25 types of sales stories from my last book? No. But do you need to be able to tell one? Yeah, probably so. So that's kind of how the list came to be. So, all right, are you ready for the 10?
Let's do it.
Okay. So the first four kind of go together because they're about setting the direction for the organization. So the first one is where we came from. So that's the founding story. Then why we can't stay there. That's a case for change story. Then where we're going, a vision story. And fourth, how we're going to get there, which is a strategy story. So my thinking is, if you can tell those four stories well, you're much more likely to get the organization to be able to go where it is you want them to go, because you're able to compellingly articulate where we came from, why we can't stay, where we're going, and how we're going to get there, right? That seems to me to be the most important four parts of setting direction for the organization. Make sense?
Yes. And while a lot of people might think, oh, sure, that's the CEO, I think those number two, three, and four definitely, all four, salespeople could use those all day long. Because you think about making a case for change, regardless of whatever product or service you're selling change.
Yeah.
And you have to be a good guide to help them see, where they could be going. So,
right.
My
yes.
two cents.
Thank you. All right, so the next four kind of go together as well, but they're more about who we are as an organization. So number five is what we believe. So that's a corporate value story. Six is who we serve. So that's a customer story, a story about the customer so that everybody can have a visceral understanding of who it is that you serve. The next one is what we do for our customers. So that's a classical sales story, probably a customer success story. And then number eight is how we're different from our competitors. So I call that a marketing story, because marketing is typically about differentiating yourself from your competitors. So if you can tell those four stories, you're much more likely to really be able to articulate who your company is, who you serve, what you do for them, and how you're different from your competitors, right? That's basically the next four, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that if you're doing the math, there's two more. So number 9 and 10. And,
if you're playing the home game.
That's right. So, and those are more personal to you as the leader. So number 9 is why I lead the way I do. So that's a personal leadership philosophy story, all right, to help your organization understand, how you lead and why you lead the way you do. And number 10 is why you should want to work here. And the you is whoever you're talking to. So it's essentially, I call it a recruiting story. But again, as you said, it's not just for the HR department to tell. Any leader at an organization has some responsibility to find and bring in talented people to work, in the department, right? So everybody needs to be able to tell a recruiting story that helps people understand why you should want to come and work here. So those are the 10. Now, I'm sure you could think of some more that you'd love to see on the list, or we could maybe negotiate over that. But using my four criteria, these are the 10 that I came up with. And I think most people that I talk to about this, when I tell them the 10, their head nods. Okay, yes, those are definitely 10 stories that I need to have as a leader.
Mm-hmm. So if we could, I would like to start with the customer story. And in part, we won't be able to go into all 10 of these. Come on, yep. Folks. You do need to buy this and buy it for your leadership too. Chapter 6, Who We Serve, A Customer Story. You have various things in the book that I'm going to steal and put in presentations, but particularly this. Spy novelist John le Carré once observed, a desk is a dangerous place from which to view the world. If the only customer information used in your organization comes from dry PowerPoint presentations and impersonal statistical data, you probably don't understand your customer any better than you understand your own medical charts. So let's talk about a customer story and an example of one and some of the things that somebody could do to start putting the customer story together.
So the idea behind the customer story is that not everybody in the company is going to have an opportunity to spend a significant amount of time with your customers. Your salespeople probably are, your customer service people probably are, some of the senior executives probably are, but the vast majority of people at most companies will never even meet a customer, all right? And that's unfortunate because it's important to know who you're working for, who you're making this product or delivering this service for. So the idea in this chapter is if you are somebody who's fortunate enough to be in a position that you get to visit with customers on a regular basis, then what you want to do is craft a story about one of your experiences so that when you tell that story to other people at your company who've never met the customer, they feel like they know them as well as you do, even though you're the one that met them. So you want to let them get to know that customer on a personal, visceral, human level, as opposed to just a bunch of demographics and stuff from a report that they can probably read. So the best type of customer story, for this purpose is a story about a time that you met a customer that it made a meaningful impact on you. So the example in the book is from a brand manager named Rohini. I probably didn't put her name in the book, but we'll stop with the first name there. And she worked on a brand of feminine hygiene products in India. And she was going to go out on a 3-day research, home to go, you know, door to door type in-home research with consumers who bought FemCare products. Specifically, were buying her brand of FemCare products to find out why they're buying it and what they like about it and what they don't like about it and all the kind of stuff you do when you're doing research. And this is in, I think, Chennai, India, and it's a fairly poor, modest part of town. So she, you know, goes into this one woman's home. I don't think it was the first person she visited that day, but it was the most meaningful and most memorable for her. And so she's in this woman's house. It's like a one room, you know, house with very, you know, modest furnishings. And this woman is buying her product, and her product is one of the more expensive brands on the market. And by the way, what most women were using at the time in that part of India was just cloth, just cloth that they put in their underwear, right? Mm-hmm. As opposed to these, you know, expensive paper, disposable, absorbent pads and tampons and things like that. And so she's interviewing this woman, finding out, why are you spending such a significant portion of your income buying my product? And it became clear in the middle of the conversation that she wasn't buying it for herself. She was buying it for her daughter, her teenage daughter, right? Which made, okay, now all of a sudden the conversation got more interesting. So she said, okay, so you've got this 15, 16-year-old daughter. You know, why do you spend this much money on her for this product? You don't even spend that on yourself. Mm-hmm. And the woman said, well, it's because she needs to do well in school. Okay, well, how's that going to help her do well in school? Well, when she doesn't have these, then she's, you know, she's worried about staining and spotting and, you know, getting embarrassed the way, you know, a young woman might if she's in school and is on her period, right? Mm-hmm. And these products do a better job than just using cloth. And she's like, well, why is it important for her to not, you know, be embarrassed every once in a while? I mean, you know, she's probably used to that by now. Well, because she needs to do well in school. Well, why is that important? Well, she needs to get good grades. Well, why is that important? And she kept digging deeper and why is this important? And, you know, she said, well, because I want her to have options in life. I want her to be able to do well in school and get a job on her own. And so then that begged another question. Well, But you didn't do that. I mean, you got married at the age of 16 and, you know, had a family early. And, you know, isn't that okay for her too? Why is it important that she does well in school? And that is when everything got quiet. And this woman leans forward in her chair and looks at Rohini and says, because I don't want my daughter to be like me. I live my life through my children now, you know, and she, you know, she stopped short of saying that she was unhappy in her marriage or anything like that, but
she wanted options.
She clearly isn't living the life that she wants her daughter to live. Yes. And so she said, it's worth it because I want her to have a better life than me. And believe it or not, buying, you know, this particular, you know, femcare pad, she believed was a part of doing that. And it just, it, you know, that moment just was seared into Rohini's brain that, okay, that is why my product is worth paying for. You know, and this woman, you know, she didn't even know that. But now that she had this experience with this woman, she realizes how important this product is. When you might just think, well, it's just a, you know, femcare brand. It's not that important in the grand scheme of life. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it is to this woman. So anyway, that story about that one visit with that one woman among 30 or 40 that she probably visited over the course of 3 or 4 days became the most important thing that came out of that research. And she shared that story at the company she worked for. And here it is, you know, 25 years later, and it's probably still circulating because it was a meaningful moment that would teach other people at the company something about their customer that they probably didn't know and would never know unless they took the opportunity to go spend that much one-on-one time with consumers. And so the idea is, if you are someone who's fortunate enough to spend one-on-one time with your consumers or customers, write a story about the most meaningful moments, the most insightful moments that you've spent with them, and share that with the rest of the organization. And if you're not somebody who gets to spend that kind of time with a customer, you know, A, go figure out a way to get to spend that kind of time. You know, like John Le Carre said, you know, you can't just spend all your time at your desk. Get out of the office. And if that doesn't work, then go demand that somebody who does spend time with those customers write a story like that so that you can feel like you know them on a personal level.
Absolutely. And I hope everyone caught how many times in that story you said the word why. Mm. So the researcher kept going further and further, getting further, deeper billion-dollar insights just from asking why. And you also notice how quickly it went. It wasn't about the product.
Right.
That was just the very top.
It almost never is.
Yeah. Thank you. Every chapter in the book, so the listener knows, also has at the end tips to help you craft your own story as it relates to that particular chapter. And I just have to quote from the end of the customer story, just to put a period on the end of what you've said. Get out of the office and meet your customer face to face. Go on a sales call with the sales team. Tag along with the research department on a customer visit. Stop a shopper in the aisle at the grocery store when you see them buying your product. Whatever you have to do, make it happen. Amen. Amen. Got me excited. Maybe that's what slowed me down too, because I started hooping and hollering as I was reading that part. The next thing I want to talk about though is the sales story. And
yeah,
I did have to laugh at this part. So maybe that added a couple minutes because I was laughing, but yeah. It's chapter 7, what we do for our customers. And you call this one the sales story. Have you ever listened to someone explain what business they're in after which you hadn't the slightest clue what they did for a living? Of course you have. It happens to all of us. One guy might describe his company as best in class at optimizing the distribution channels between the core manufacturing center and the desired customer experience. Another woman runs a company that integrates siloed marketing platforms into a single digital information exchange. What the hell does that even mean? A mouthful of buzzwords and management speak rarely clarifies anything. Talk about a sales story.
Yeah. So the idea behind these a sales story like this is it makes that kind of gobbledygook clear.
Yes. Right?
Because anytime you've confused somebody with a bunch of lofty, vague language, they almost always ask you to do something which will clarify it. And it's, can you give me an example? Right. And then you give them an example. They go, oh, okay, well, I totally get it now. So that's what these, the sales story, these customer stories are examples of the thing that you do. So it's essentially a customer success story that's simple enough, but impressive enough too. You're going to obviously pick an impressive one so that somebody can go, oh, now I can see what you do for people, because the buzzwords don't do it. So the example I picked in here was from a guy named Ben Coberna from EasyBuy. I think that's the one you're talking about. And he does, his company runs reverse auctions. I think this is one you're thinking about. So if you don't know what a reverse auction is, basically they're a company that if your company needs something, they go out and find a bunch of people who offer that service or product, and they get them to bid on and compete for your business. So the price keeps going down and down and down until one of them cries, you know, the last one cries uncle, and it's okay. Well, now that you've gotten the product you need at the lowest price, right? And he often has a difficult time explaining that to people, because if you're not familiar with a reverse auction, it just, it seems kind of weird.
Sure.
Plus, the other big objection he typically gets when he's trying to sell his company's service is people go, well, won't my customers or my suppliers get mad at me for that? Like if you found out all of a sudden that, you know, your customer was going to get five other companies to compete on your business and either shut you out or basically take a bunch of revenue out of your pocket, that sounds like the kind of thing they'd get mad at me for. And the answer is, well, of course, they're always going to get mad. And that becomes a barrier for him selling. So what he typically does to get around that barrier and to just let them know on a concrete level, what he does is he just tells them a story about one of his first customers. And one of his first customers was a mid-sized city government in Florida. And they had been paying a company $250,000 a year to haul away the sludge from their wastewater treatment plant. And they thought, well, you know, that's a lot of money. Maybe we can get it done cheaper. So they hire his company and they go out and they find, you know, three or four other companies that do wastewater sludge removal. And they call them all up on the phone and say, hey, here's what we're doing. We're going to invite you to come bid on this business. We're going to have a meeting, you know, at this day, this time, in this place. And so they all show up. Well, the guy who's got the business now, the incumbent, walks into this meeting with his lawyer yelling and screaming about how this is terrible. You can't do this. It's illegal. You're all going to go to jail. He picks up and throws a chair across the room. I mean, the guy's livid, right? Because he's about to get a lot of money taken out of his pocket, right? Well, so they eventually got him calmed down and explained how the auction was going to work and got the auction started. So his bid, of course, his first bid is $250,000, because that's what he's been getting paid for years to do this. Well, somebody else, you know, comes in a little bit lower. So he lowers his, you know, bid to, well, $240,000 and then $210,000 and then $200,000 and then $150,000. Well, his next bid is for $0. So, they realize, well, obviously he made a mistake. He clicked the wrong button, didn't know what he's doing. So they call everybody. They stop the auction. They call him up. They, you know, tell him, hey, look, you made a mistake. You submitted zero. So here's what we're going to, you know, we pause the auction. Here's what you do. You resubmit it. And, you know, then we'll turn the auction back on. And he says, you know, you don't have to do that. It wasn't a mistake. I submitted zero on purpose. Well, that doesn't make any sense. Why would you do that? And he said, look, I've been selling that sludge to farmers for years as fertilizer. I make plenty of money on that. I'll just come pick it up for free. And that's what he's been doing ever since. So, you know, the purpose of the story, and it does get a good chuckle, but the purpose of the story is, one, it makes it very clear what his company does and how, you know, kind of the bidding process works and, you know, how you'd benefit. But it also answers that other question that a lot of customers are afraid to ask, which is, you know, isn't my incumbent supplier going to get mad at me? Mm-hmm. Because he can then explain, well, yeah, they're all going to get mad. Now, they're not all going to show up with a lawyer and throw a chair across the room. But if they do get mad, they're going to get mad at me, Ben Coberna, not you. You're not even in the room.
You can keep playing golf with them if you want.
Exactly. All you get to do is save money. Part of my job is to save you all of that emotional turmoil and stress and yelling and save you money. So then the story makes it very clear that, you know, the client is not even part of that meeting. So that's, you know, just one example, but, you know, you can clearly see in there, you know, what the company does for a living, and it resolves some objections up front that the client, the prospect might have.
Talks about the problem they solve, and it's very memorable. Very memorable. Right. It was one of my favorite stories from the book. So moving on just to one other, and then there might be time for a couple others, but that's the one about how we're different from our competitors. And again, I can see why your book is a finalist for great literature. This is the marketing story. As any first-year MBA student can attest, marketing is largely about differentiation. It communicates how your product or service is different from your many competitors. And that's important because, as I learned from interviewing procurement managers at dozens of companies, competitors in many industries are so similar that it's difficult for even professional buyers to tell them apart. Yeah. Ouch!
Exactly. Yeah, nobody wants to admit that, but it turns out it's true. I had so many procurement managers tell me that. Yeah, so you definitely need a marketing story, and most marketers have, you know, lots of marketing and copy, but you need some marketing stories as well. And this example will make it clear. So the example here is from Sherrod Madison, who's the CEO of United Building Maintenance, which is a commercial cleaning company. So these are the folks that come into your office at night and clean up. And when he gets a new client, he always does the same thing. There's always a 30-day transition period between when he signs the contract with them and when his company actually takes over. And during that 30 days, he'll go into the building, he'll like sneak in the middle of the night to see what they're doing now. Because I think at the end of the 30 days, when his company takes over, most of the employees are contract employees, so they're going to become his employees. So he wants to know if they're well-trained and, you know, doing a good job and all that. And when he's calling on a new prospect, he's got his regular sales pitch he gives, but he almost always tells them a story about what he does during those middle of the night, you know, sneak into the building to see what's going on. So he might say, for example, you know, last month we took over the Verizon building in New Jersey. And so, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm in there, you know, snooping around, and I find some guy, you know, shampooing the carpets or vacuuming the carpets. And he said, this guy's using the same kind of residential quality vacuum cleaner that I use at home. Right. And the thing is, those corridors are 12 feet wide and a half a mile around. I mean, it's going to take the guy a month just to vacuum the carpets once, and it's not going to do a very good job. Plus, that machine's going to break down every couple of weeks because it's not made for that kind of volume. Mm-hmm. So he said, when we took over, we put him into one of those, you know, a triple wide commercial grade vacuum cleaner that'll do the job in a fraction of the time. Plus, it'll do a much, you know, more quality job. He said, well, you know, I went to another floor and saw somebody shampooing the carpets, and kind of the same story. He's using the same kind of walk behind, you know, squeeze bottle shampooer that I use at home. And it's the same problem. It's not going to work very well. It's going to take too long. So when we took over, we put the guy into one of those industrial commercial grade riding shampooers, you know, that obviously does the job much faster and much better. Plus it gets the guy off his feet, which means I have fewer workman's comp issues, which means my client has fewer workman's comp issues. He said, but the last thing I wanted to do is I wanted to see how they're dusting the offices. So I went up another floor and found the office room, you know, the offices. And I looked on top of the file cabinets. And sure enough, I see the same thing on top of every single one of them. A half a moon swiped out on top. And he said, I know exactly what that means. And you probably do too. He said, those cabinets are 5.5 feet tall, standard height of file cabinets in the U.S. And he said, some of the people doing the cleaning are less than that tall. So it's not that they're lazy. They just literally aren't tall enough to reach all the way to the back. So they just, that's what leaves that half moon swipe out.
They're doing the best they can.
Yeah, yeah. And he said, but the truth is they'd be better off not dusting it at all because it's the contrast between the dusty part and the clean part that makes it obvious that it's not being cleaned properly. So I said, when we took over, I just gave them all these little 18-inch plastic extension wands so they could reach all the way to the back. You know, boom, problem solved, like that. Now, and that's the end of it. That's the story that he tells. And he could, instead of telling that story, of course, he could just say, look, there are three reasons why I'm better than my competition. First, we use triple wide industrial grade vacuum cleaners. Secondly, we use these commercial grade riding shampoo machines. And third, all of our dusters use 18-inch extension wands. So that's why we're better. And that is true. I mean, those are the features and the benefits that he's selling. Those are his key differentiating characteristics. But you can tell now, having heard the story, that the story does such a better job of articulating those features and benefits than just being given the list of the features and benefits. Because now that you've heard that story, you can see in your mind's eye that guy, you know, shampooing the carpets, you know, riding around like the Zamboni driver at the ice skating rink, right? Mm-hmm. And you can see somebody easily reaching the back of the file cabinets with the extension wand. And so you're in your mind's eye, you can see these differentiators playing out. And that makes it far more memorable, far more impactful than just being given the list of the features and benefits. So yes, all marketers need to know what their features and benefits are, but you need a story to communicate those, a real story about something that happened to someone, not just a fancy way of explaining the features and benefits.
Yes. So, Paul, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
I guess I hope it would be, I need these 10 stories. I need to go look for them now. Right. As opposed to, you know, in my other books, I talk about, you know, how to craft these stories and the structure behind the stories and how do you create emotional engagement and all that. But the whole purpose of this book is to convince you that you need some stories and that these are the stories you should start with. I think you need more than 10 stories, but if you, this is the place to start. You should start by getting these 10 stories, and you're going to have to go find them. You can't just make them up, right? That's part of what we mentioned earlier. I mean, there's maybe one of these stories, like the vision story, that is going to be fictional because it's about the future. Well, the future hasn't happened yet, so obviously it's fictional. But most of these are about things that really happen. So you're going to have to go do some homework and find examples of these things happening and crafting a story around it.
Yeah, what's interesting is at the end of the book, you have this worksheet, and it's got the 10 stories. But don't feel like you have to go get all 10 right away. Figure out which one, put them in priority and figure out which one is the most important for your situation and just go focus on that one. Get started with that one. So,
right. Yeah. And some of my clients even assign them so that, you know, so Douglas, you're going to take story 1 and 2. I'm going to do stories, you know, 3 and 4, you know, Janet's going to do, you know, 5 and 6 or whatever, and have different people working on them and you'll come up with them quicker. But yeah, you don't have to tackle all 10, you know, right away.
Right. So you may have already answered this, but what is one thing the listener can go do today to put in action one of the many ideas from your book?
Pick the most important story for you and go find it and craft it and deliver it. So yeah, pick one. Pick one of these 10 stories and go find it. And that means you're going to have to interview some people.
Right, right. But I could almost envision a team getting, everybody reads the book, and then they get together, and then they have a little workshop of, all right, let's figure out what the first one needs to be, or let's prioritize it, and then go off and do it, and everybody come back next week. I'm just envisioning.
Right.
And then they'll get it wrong, and then they'll need to hire you.
Well, that's fine too. But that's what I do. I mean, I do workshops where we'll tackle 3 or 4 of these in a single day with, you know, a dozen people in a room, you know, walk through the steps of crafting these stories. And which that's not part of what is in the book. This book really is about what stories you need and where to find them, as opposed to the nuts and bolts of story craft. That's what some of my other books do. But yeah, you got to start somewhere.
Right. And even a 1 or 5 person company could go do this. So. Yes. Are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or are looking forward to reading?
Yeah, you know, and this is going to sound terribly self-serving, but I actually have another book coming out next month. So it's weird. I've got two books coming. Yeah, I have 2 books coming out in
the You need to wait 168 quarter. Episodes, though.
You told me I didn't have to. I only mention this because you're probably not going to be interested in it, but it's an interesting topic. So I will mention it. And then you can cut it out if you're not interested. But
what is it?
It's a biography of a cognitively impaired, deaf and partially blind man. All right. So this is a 65-year-old man who was born deaf in both ears and partially blind in one eye and with a learning disability. So he's probably got the cognitive ability of about a 4th or 5th grader. So he's kind of like a combination of a Helen Keller and Forrest Gump, even though Forrest Gump's fictional. But he's just got a unique set of challenges in life, and it's just led the most fascinating life, you know, as a result of that. And he's just an amazing human being. And I met the guy 5 or 6 years ago, and I just knew immediately that the world needs to meet this person and, you know, needs to know how can he be such a charming human being, which he is. And you know, if it was me, if I had all of those difficulties in life, I would probably be a very unpleasant person to be around. But he's not. And that just fascinated me. And I spent the last several years interviewing him, and I finally found the right time and the right a publisher, and it's all kind of come together. And in November, just next month, 4 Days with Kenny Tedford is the name of the book, will come out. And the title, the reason for that title is that even though I interviewed him over the course of several years, the bulk of our interviews happened in 4 days at my house. So he came to visit me because I can't just call him on the phone, right? I mean, he's deaf and I don't speak sign language. So we literally have to be in the same room together, and he reads my lips. And so he literally came to my house and spent 4 days, and he walked in the front door, basically a stranger. And by the time he left, I mean, he was part of my family. It was just, it was amazing because I'd heard his entire life story in 4 days, but he also got to meet my wife and my kids, and they wanted to hear all of his stories. And it was just, it became this, those 4 days were four of the most amazing days in my life. And so the book is not just about his life, but it's about the impact that he had in those 4 days on my family. So I'm a character in the book. My wife and kids are characters in the book, obviously along with Kenny Tedford, So that'll come out next month. And the end of the book, the last chapter, are lessons, life lessons from Kenny Tedford, specifically for people who have, you know, different kinds of physical and mental disabilities in life, but also for the people who care for them. And I think really for all of us. So we spent a lot of time after we dissected his entire life, trying to figure out what are lessons that other people could apply to their life.
That sounds unbelievably inspirational.
Yeah.
And why can't Hollywood make movies like that?
Well, they make wonderful movies all the time, and I think this would be a great one for them, and maybe they will someday. So you asked what book I'm excited about and even interested in reading.
I'm glad you mentioned that. I really am.
Yeah. But I'm looking forward to see it, you know, in final version in print. And so that's the book I'm most excited about seeing in the next month or two.
Yeah. Terrific. Super. So at marketingbookpodcast.com, we're going to include links to your website, Lead with a Story, and social media. And we're going to include your LinkedIn profile so listeners can connect with you. And thank you for joining us on the show. And listeners, the authors love it when you all message them, whether it's on Twitter or LinkedIn or whatever. So please thank Paul for joining us today. And also, Paul is the host of 3 podcasts. And each one, it's about your 3 big books.
Yeah, the first 3 books, yeah.
Yeah. And as I recall, back in episode 87, I'm acting as if I can remember these things specifically. Yeah. But so tell me the name of the 3 podcasts.
Yeah, so I copied the name on my first 3 books. So Lead with a Story, Parenting with a Story, and Sell with a Story. So what I talk about in those podcasts is really not necessarily the same thing that's in the books. It's basically a leadership podcast, a parenting podcast, and a sales podcast. So I have other guests on, other experts in the areas of leadership and parenting and sales, and I share stories from my books and other places. But what I'm not teaching you how to do is how to craft stories in the podcast, which is the main subject of the books. I'm just sharing wisdom from that genre. So leadership wisdom, parenting wisdom, sales wisdom.
Terrific. And as I recall, and I could be wrong, I often am, when I interviewed you before, you already had the first 2 podcasts. And I said, wow, you seem to start a podcast about each of your books. Are you going to start a podcast about sales? And you said, oh, no. 2's enough. Look at you hosting 3. Well, so
apparently I lied to you.
Well, you know, either that or you got to be careful what
I predicted wrong.
What podcasts you or you have to be careful what new books you write. So
exactly.
For you, dear listener, if you're listening on your smartphone and you've subscribed to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app, all these links can be found by going to this episode and clicking on the show notes link. The name of the book is The 10 Stories Great Leaders Tell. The author is Paul Smith. Paul, thank you very much for returning to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm happy to be here, and I hope it's not another 167 or however many you said before we do it again.
Okay. And that closes the book on episode 255 of the Marketing Book Podcast. For more, check out this episode's show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. And if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or other helpful resource for whatever situation you find yourself in, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat, and I'll try to point you in the right direction. My name again is Douglas Burdett. Special thanks to our sponsor, Blinkist, to support the Marketing Book Podcast and start your free Blinkist trial or get 20% off your yearly plan. Visit Blinkist.com/marketingbookpodcast. I also have a link to the special offer at marketingbookpodcast.com. And please join us next time as we welcome back, for the 6th time, the king of the Marketing Book Podcast, none other than Mark Schaefer, to talk about his new book, Lessons, Essays to Help You Embrace the Chaos. Thanks again for listening to the Marketing Book Podcast. This episode was produced by Amanda Harrison.
Yeah, so just so you know, so that John Le Carre, now I know how to pronounce it. The first sentence is his. A desk is a dangerous place from which to view the world. The next sentence you read was me. Like, if the only customer information used in your organization comes from dry PowerPoint presentations, right, you probably don't understand your customer any better than you understand your own medical charts. That was me.
Ever tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller, find your next obsession, or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first three audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.